From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Torture is prohibited in Guantanamo. It's prohibited anywhere in the world by any of our U.S. government agencies holding people anywhere in the world. It's also simply wrong as a matter of law to state that holding individuals indefinitely without charging them is wrong.
The United States has rejected calls by the United Nations for the closure of its prison camp at Guantanamo Bay. A UN panel issued a report last week that said the indefinite detention of prisoners at Guantanamo violates the world's ban on torture. We'll speak with one of the 10 members of the UN Committee Against Torture, as well as the International Legal Director of Human Rights First.
The Committee Against Torture issued a very strong report against the United States practices of secret detention, enforced disappearances. It concerned domestic problems in U.S. prisons. It rejected just about every contention the United States made that it was in compliance with its international obligations.
Then former U.S. Army chaplain and Guantanamo prisoner, James Yee.
The ages of some of the prisoners down there. As young as 12 to 14 years old, prisoners as young as 12 to 14 years old were being held down in Guantanamo when I was there.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, lawmakers have finally formed a new unity government 5 months after the December election. The government, led by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, met for the first time this week inside the U.S.-controlled Green Zone. Several key cabinet positions remain unfilled, including Minister of Defense and Minister of the Interior. On Sunday, President Bush called leaders in Iraq to congratulate them on the new government.
The formation of a unity government in Iraq is a new day for the millions of Iraqis who want to live in freedom. And the formation of the unity government in Iraq begins a new chapter in our relationship with Iraq.
The New York Times reports the Bush administration played a major role in the formation of the new government. The U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, personally vetted and reviewed candidates for crucial ministries and urged rival Iraqi party leaders to sign on to the new government. U.S. officials are also being placed inside key ministries to act as advisors. On Sunday, the new Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki vowed to bring stability to Iraq and to use maximum force to end the violence that's killed thousands in recent months. Middle East analyst Juan Cole said four distinct wars are now being fought in Iraq simultaneously. There is a Sunni-Arab guerrilla war to expel U.S. troops from the Sunni heartland, a militant Shiite guerrilla war to expel the British from the south, a civil war between the Sunni Shiites and the Kurdish war against Arabs and Turkmen in Kirkuk province. British journalist Patrick Coburn says Iraq is disintegrating as ethnic cleansing takes hold on a massive scale. On Sunday, at least 24 people died, including 13 at a Baghdad restaurant that was attacked by a suicide bomber. In Afghanistan, a U.S.-led airstrike has killed at least 76 people. The BBC reports the dead include as many as 30 civilians, including children. The bombing raid in southern Afghanistan occurred shortly after midnight today. The U.S. military has denied reports of civilian casualties and claimed that all the dead were members of the Taliban. The airstrike occurred in a region which has recently seen some of the country's fiercest fighting since the fall of the Taliban nearly 5 years ago. In New Orleans, Ray Nagin has been reelected as the city's mayor in a closely watched election that came about 9 months after Hurricane Katrina devastated the city.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for one New Orleans. It's time for one New Orleans today. It's time for one New Orleans tomorrow. It's time for one New Orleans forever. And as Gandhi once said, I close. Gandhi said it best. He said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. God bless you.
Ray Nagin, a former telecom executive, won 52% of the vote. Louisiana's Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu won 48%. It was the city's closest mayoral election ever. Landrieu would have become the city's first white mayor since his father held the post in the late 70s. The vote came at a time that half New Orleans residents still haven't been able to return home, including as many as 200,000 registered voters, mostly African American. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times reports a new study has raised questions about the strength of the levees around New Orleans. Engineers at UC Berkeley said the levees have a wide range of design and construction defects, and that there are serious doubts that the system can withstand the pounding of another hurricane the size of Katrina. The paper reports the findings undermine assurances by the Bush administration and the Army Corps of Engineers that the $3 billion spent on the levees will provide a higher level of protection to New Orleans. The study also questions the competency of the Corps of Engineers to oversee public safety projects across the nation. The study criticized the Corps for not detecting problems such as the fact that sections of the levees were built with crushed seashells. Questions are being raised over whether the CIA will continue to use an interrogation method known as waterboarding, despite last year's congressional ban on the cruel, degrading, and inhumane treatment of detainees. The technique involves immersing a prisoner's head in water to make them think that they're drowning. Human rights groups consider it a form of torture. In 2004, a CIA inspector general concluded that waterboarding and other methods approved by the agency after 9/11 probably violated the International Convention Against Torture. Last week, President Bush's pick to head the CIA, General Michael Hayden, refused to publicly state whether he considers waterboarding to be an acceptable practice. He was questioned by California Senator Dianne Feinstein.
On March 17, 2005, Director Porter Goss stated to the Senate Armed Services Committee that waterboarding fell into, quote, an area of what I will call professional interrogation techniques, end quote. Do you agree with that assessment? Do you agree with Mr. Goss's statement that waterboarding may be acceptable? If not, what steps have been taken or do you plan to take to correct the impression that may have been left with agency employees by Mr. Goss's remarks?
Yes, ma'am. And again, let me defer that to closed session and I would be happy to discuss it in some detail.
That was General Michael Hayden responding to questions from California Senator Dianne Feinstein. The country's prison population here has reached almost $2.2 million. One in every 136 U.S. residents is now behind bars. The nation's prison population increased by more than 1,000 prisoners a week last year. New data also shows that 12% of African American men between the ages of 25 and 29 are now incarcerated. That's more than 10 times the incarceration rate of white men. Meanwhile, a new report from the Women's Prison Association has found the number of women imprisoned in the United States has increased by over 750% since 1977. In the Gaza Strip, fighting has intensified between Palestinian factions loyal to Hamas and the former ruling party Fatah. On Saturday, the Palestinians' chief intelligence officer, Tariq Abu Rashab, was seriously wounded in an attempt on his life. On Sunday, security officials found a 150-pound bomb planted along a road used by Gaza's security chief, Rashid Abu Shbak. Both officials are allies of former Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. On Sunday, Abbas said he feared the fighting between Hamas and Fatah could lead to civil war. Meanwhile, Israel is continuing to carry out its campaign of assassinating Palestinian militants inside the Gaza Strip. On Saturday, an Israeli missile struck a car carrying a commander in the militant group Islamic Jihad. The attack killed a man and three others, including a four-year-old boy. In Washington, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez suggested Sunday the Justice Department may begin prosecuting journalists for writing articles based on classified information. Under the Espionage Act of 1917, it's a crime for an unauthorized person to receive national defense information and transmit it to others, but it has seldom, if ever, been used to target journalists. Gonzalez's comments came on ABC's This Week. He was questioned by George Stephanopoulos.
So you believe journalists can be prosecuted for publishing classified information?
Well, again, George, it depends on the circumstances. There are some statutes on the book which, if you read the language carefully, would seem to indicate that that is a possibility. That's a policy judgment by the Congress in passing that kind of legislation. We have an obligation to enforce those laws. We have an obligation to ensure that our national security is protected.
That was Alberto Gonzalez appearing on ABC's This Week. In other news from Washington, the FBI has raided the office of Democratic Congressmember William Jefferson of Louisiana as part of a bribery investigation. Authorities said it marked the first time the FBI has ever raided the office of a sitting congressman. 15 FBI agents entered his office just after 7 p.m. on Saturday and left about 18 hours later. Jefferson has not yet been charged with a crime, but the FBI claims it has videotape evidence that he accepted a $100,000 bribe last year from a person cooperating with the FBI. In labor news, a coal mine explosion in Kentucky has killed 5 miners. So far this year, 31 miners have now died in accidents, making it the deadliest year for the mine industry since 2001. The Nobel Peace Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz has publicly backed Bolivia's decision to nationalize its vast gas and oil reserves and to renegotiate all contracts with foreign oil companies. Stiglitz met with Bolivian President Evo Morales Friday in La Paz. The former World Bank official said Bolivia was right to receive just compensation for its natural resources and that nationalization is part of a process of returning what already belonged to the Bolivian government. Stiglitz added, it is clear that the neoliberal economic policies of Washington have failed the people of Bolivia. In Chile, newly elected President Michelle Bachelet gave her first State of the Nation address Sunday and vowed to invest heavily in health, housing, and education.
Today, I present to the country the 4 major transformations my government will push. These are big changes in 4 areas that are crucial for us to overcome exclusion and to construct a society that is more inclusive. We have the historic mandate to do it. We have the obligation to reach 2010 with a more modern country that is integrated and developed. The first transformation is centered in Chile's private pension system. Without dignified and secure pensions, there cannot be peaceful aging. The second transformation will happen in the education system. We need more preschools and schools and clubs of higher quality for the older children. The third transformation has to do with innovation and implementation of new policies to stimulate growth. The fourth transformation will permit us to have friendly neighborhoods with a good quality of life for the people.
Michelle Bachelet, who is Chile's first female president, also promised to seek truth and justice for human rights violations committed during the U.S.-backed military dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet. Bachelet said the country should never stop searching for the dissidents who were disappeared by the Pinochet regime. Both Bachelet and her mother were tortured under Pinochet. Her father was a general who was tortured and died. And the world-renowned dancer, choreographer, and social activist Katharine Dunham has died at the age of 96. Dunham is best known for leaving Broadway to teach in one of America's poorest cities, East St. Louis. In 1992, she went on a 47-day hunger strike to protest U.S. policy that repatriated Haitian refugees. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. has rejected calls by the United Nations for the closure of its prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said, quote, we cannot be in a situation in which we're just turning loose on helpless populations or unprotected populations, people who have vowed to kill more Americans if they're released. There are about 460 prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay. Most have been held for more than 4 years without charge. A UN panel said Friday the indefinite detention of prisoners at Guantanamo violates the world's ban on torture. In issuing its report, the Committee Against Torture recommended the closure of Guantanamo, an end to secret CIA prisons, and an end to abusive treatment and interrogation techniques against detainees. The UN report comes a day after several suicide attempts and a clash between prisoners and guards at Guantanamo. According to the U.S. military, several prisoners wielding improvised weapons attacked guards as they entered a communal living area to stop a prisoner who was trying to hang himself. There have been 39 suicide attempts at Guantanamo since the prison opened in January of 2002. The 11-page UN report was issued after 4 days of hearings in Geneva. It was the first time since the start of the Bush administration's so-called war on terror that the U.S. government was subject to questioning by an international body about treatment of detainees in U.S. custody. The U.N. Committee Against Torture is in charge of monitoring compliance with the U.N. Convention Against Torture. That treaty prohibits its signatories from using cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment on prisoners and mandates that countries ensure that any detainee is given minimum legal rights. The U.S. ratified the treaty in 1994. The U.S. government's delegation was headed by John Bellinger, who is the legal advisor to the State Department. This is Bellinger on Friday responding to the report.
The committee's conclusion was that detaining persons indefinitely without charge is a per se violation of the convention. Well, that's just simply legally inaccurate. There is nothing in the convention that says anything about holding people indefinitely. I mean, this is an issue that we know is out there, but there is nothing in this convention that says anything about holding people. So it's outside of the scope for them to be calling for the closure of Guantanamo. This convention has to do with torture, and we have said that torture is clearly prohibited. Torture is prohibited in Guantanamo. It's prohibited anywhere in the world by any of our U.S. government agencies holding people anywhere in the world. It's also simply wrong as a matter of law to state that holding individuals indefinitely without charging them is wrong. In any kind of a war, you hold people indefinitely until the end of the conflict without charge.
That was John Bellinger III speaking on Friday in Washington, D.C. The report released this weekend is the most recent call for shutting down the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. Earlier this month, British Attorney General Peter Goldsmith called for the prison to close, saying it was, quote, an unacceptable symbol of injustice. And in February, the U.N.'s Commission on Human Rights called Guantanamo illegal and said it should be shut down. We're joined now in our Firehouse studio by Gabor Rona. He is the International Legal Director of Human Rights First. He was at the hearings last week in Geneva. And on the telephone with us from Norway, we're joined by Dr. Nora Svass. She is one of 10 members of the UN Committee Against Torture. She's also a psychologist with the Norwegian Center for Studies on Violence and Traumatic Stress. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I wanted to begin with Dr. Svass. Your committee came out with this report. Can you summarize it for us? What were the most egregious violations you found causing you to call for the closure of Guantanamo?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'd like to start with underlining the importance of this kind of work that that the conclusions that's called now the report is actually recommendations on the committee after having considered the reports that were submitted by the State Party, in this case, the U.S. So we had, as it was said, several days where we were able to discuss and highlight several issues. So what's in our report now are the concerns that are still left after this discussion. And basically, I think the main issue here is that that there is an absolute prohibition against torture and that this should be respected by all state parties. And the absolute prohibition is also applies to armed conflict, and it applies to all territories under the jurisdiction of the state party, and it also covers all personnel involved in law enforcement, control, etc., also private contractors or non-U.S. citizens involved in operations or special missions. So to us, it's been perhaps the most vital point to underline is that the prohibition must be respected absolutely, also in situations where it's referred to will intelligence or to lex specialis, as, for instance, has been the case as to Guantanamo. I think that would be perhaps the most important issues that we discussed, and that's also in our recommendation.
Gabor Rona of Human Rights First, you were there in Geneva, and you were also here when the committee came to the United States. Can you explain the significance of this panel and also the level of cooperation of the U.S. government?
First, thank you for having me on, Amy. The significance of this entire process is that, in addition to what you mentioned, this is the first time that the U.S. has come before the scrutiny of an international legal body since the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. This is not a situation in which the U.S. appeared because it was being called on the carpet. Quite the contrary, states are required to file periodic reports to the committee, which is charged with monitoring compliance with the Torture Convention. And the U.S. is a party to the Torture Convention. So this is a routine process. What I think was not routine, though, was the fact that the United States sent a large and very high-level delegation to Geneva to appear before the Committee Against Torture, expressed its respect for the process and for the expertise of the members of this committee. It's an independent committee. It's not a political committee. The people on the committee are experts in their field. And the United States presented very detailed information about its legal arguments, asserting why it felt it was in compliance with its international legal obligations, but did not present a great deal of information about its practices, the facts. And it was gratifying to see that the committee rejected much of the United States' legal posturing, invited the United States to provide more information about actual practices, and in no uncertain terms was critical of the United States' practices of secret detentions, of interrogation techniques that amount to torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, of the process of extraordinary rendition, which is nothing more than enforced disappearances, and of several practices taking place within the U.S. criminal justice system, supermax prisons, and police stations.
We only have a minute, but how significant is this? I mean, it's an international body. The Bush administration has been, for a while now, rejecting international treaties and bodies' recommendations.
The significance is that it represents the opinion of a neutral world body. The United States has expressed its respect for this process, cannot any longer say that this is a biased process, cannot say that this is a number of conclusions that they simply reject because of the nature of the source.
A UN report also saying prison authorities in the United States have failed to protect prisoners here against sexual violence.
There were conclusions drawn by the committee concerning sexual violence in U.S. prison, 23 to 24-hour lockdowns being standard process in the supermaxes, sexual violence against children in prisons, abuses against women, particularly women who are in childbirth. There were quite a number of specifics addressed by the committee about U.S. practices.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. They've also called for an investigation of the Chicago case, where a judge has said the report should be released on at least two decades of perhaps close to 200 men being tortured in Chicago jails. Gabor Rona, thanks for being with us from Human Rights First, and Dr. Norris Vass, a psychologist with the UN Committee Against Torture, speaking to us from Norway. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
And after 400 years, independence was short. That's just how it is with the Deepwater Port. The battleships came and they never left shore. Tasting the conquest, they just wanted more. The sign, it said, welcome to the U.S. of A. In the Republic of Cuba, Guantanamo Bay. The barbed wire and the field of mines, you can see the men who left their families behind to burn neath the sun, to be tortured and killed, where their stomachs are empty and their spirits are grilled. If you're looking for freedom, this is the price you must pay. It's written in blood on Guantanamo Bay. Vultures, they circle at ease overhead.
David Rovick singing Guantanamo Bay here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue to look at the issue of torture and Guantanamo Bay. On May 5th, the University of California at Davis sponsored an event called A Conversation About Guantanamo. I moderated the event. Among those there were former Army Chaplain James Yee. He spoke about his own experience, a Muslim chaplain who was posted at Guantanamo in 2002, but less than a year after serving there, he was accused of espionage by the military and faced charges so severe he was threatened with the death penalty. He was locked away in a Navy prison in Charleston, South Carolina, spent 76 days in solitary confinement subject to abusive treatment. We will let him, though, tell his own story, leading to the dropping of all charges against him. Yee wrote his book called For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. This is James Yee talking about his own experience.
But starting with a little bit about myself, it was mentioned that I'm a West Point graduate, but I want to say that I'm also part of a family that's actually deeply rooted in the military. Not only did I graduate from West Point, but also I have a younger brother who graduated from West Point. I have another younger brother who's actually an Army doctor, currently serving on active duty at Fort Lewis, Washington. And being a third-generation Chinese American, my father was also drafted during World War II, and he served after being drafted during that time. So I actually come from a family that has its roots in the military, and that's something we're all proud of in terms of serving the armed forces and being a part of the military. But with that, I was assigned in 2002, in November, to be the Muslim chaplain down in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the controversial prison camp that we're all talking about today. And really, at first, I didn't know what my role was going to be when I was assigned to that mission, this Joint Task Force mission. I thought perhaps I was being sent down to Gitmo, as we call it, so that our government, the Pentagon, could say, oh, yes, we do have a Muslim chaplain assigned to this sensitive operation in where all of the prisoners down there are of the Muslim faith. We do have a Muslim chaplain there. And, of course, that means we're being sensitive to the religious needs of these prisoners. I thought perhaps that was the reason why I was being sent down there. But, nevertheless, I went down there with confidence in myself as a Muslim chaplain, someone who immediately after 9/11 was approached by senior leaders within the military to talk about Islam, to build bridges, and to educate soldiers and service members about the Islamic culture. I went to Guantanamo with that same confidence in myself that I would do the same job which I was recognized for in the immediate post 9/11 era. Well, when I got down there, I actually found out what my role was going to be. And it was, one, to be an advisor to the camp commander who was down there, to advise the commander of the detention operation on this unique religious paradigm where we do find that every single one of the prisoners caged in these open-air cell cages are Muslim. I was to advise on how their religious routine, how their religious practices of the prisoners affected the operation. But I also would learn that I would be a chaplain to the prisoners. A chaplain to the prisoners. And I was in a unique position where I had that opportunity or that position to be able to interact with the prisoners on a very personal level. And as a result, I was given authorized and escorted access into the prison cell blocks. And I would meet with the prisoners on a daily basis, hour after hour, every day I would be in the cell blocks speaking with the prisoners and listening to them. Most importantly, I was listening to them. In the military, we say that a good chaplain is a good listener. And that's what I would do. I would listen to the prisoners. And what did they have to say? Well, they would tell me much about what was going on in Guantanamo, what life is like for them as prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And of course, they had many complaints and many concerns. Many complaints and many concerns was often led to protests on the part of the prisoners, riots or disturbances. The prisoners even responded even more drastically with things like hunger strikes and even suicide attempts in protest of how they were being treated, or should I say, how they were being mistreated and abused. In listening to the prisoners, I often learned what was going on inside the interrogation rooms down in Guantanamo. Now realize that down at Gitmo, there are two operations. There's a detention operation and there's an intelligence gathering operation. The detention operation is run mostly by military police, guards, who handle the everyday needs of the prisoners. They bring the prisoners food, change the clothes, they take them to showers, recreation, those kind of things. In the intelligence operations, you have mostly intel officers, interrogators, military intelligence, and others who we in the military only refer to as OGA, meaning other government agencies. Who are these other government agencies? Could be the FBI, the Defense Intelligence Agency, perhaps the CIA, whoever. But within the military, we only knew them as OGA. So that's the intelligence gathering operation, their mission to try and glean information from the prisoners, if they have any. As the Muslim chaplain, of course, I was assigned to the detention operation, really being unethical for a chaplain of any denomination to assist interrogators in their role in trying to glean information from prisoners. So I was assigned to the detention operation. And in the course of interacting with the prisoners, I would learn much of what was going on. And what would they tell me? They would tell me about the abuses. And one of the things that I've recently done was I wrote about my experience. I chronicled it in a book called For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. And one of the chapters that I entitled is a chapter I entitled Gitmo's Secret Weapon. Gitmo's Secret Weapon. Now, what was Gitmo's secret weapon? Well, from the viewpoint of a chaplain in the United States military, whose role is essentially to advocate for the free exercise of worship for all individuals, to advocate for religious freedom, Gitmo's secret weapon was the use of religion against the prisoners, whether to try and break them or frustrate them in the course of trying to glean information from them or in the course of detaining them. Now, how was religion being used against the prisoners? Well, prisoners would come and they would tell me that when they were taken to interrogation, they were, of course, shackled at the wrist and at the waist and at the ankles, as prisoners down in Guantanamo are shackled. And they would tell me that they would be forced to sit in the center of what was painted on the floor, a satanic circle. The interrogators would attempt to force them to bow down and prostrate, you know, like in the form of the Islamic prayer where Muslims bow down and prostrate. While the interrogator is screaming at that prisoner that Satan is your God now, not Allah. This is how religion was being used against the prisoners. But how else was religion being used? Prisoners would tell me that female interrogators, for example, would take advantage of conservative Islamic culture or etiquette, in where you find in an Islamic society very limited physical contact between members of the opposite sex, with the exception of marital relations or family relations, like between a mother and her son, or between a niece and her uncle, those kind of things. Prisoners would say that the female interrogators in particular would take advantage of this aspect of Muslim culture. How? By being very ready to take off their clothes or disrobe in front of the Muslim prisoners in the course of their interrogation. And when these Muslim prisoners simply didn't want to see a naked woman, they would close their eyes. So the guards would then be instructed to go behind the prisoner and force their eyes open. Further, these female interrogators, of course, took steps to inappropriately touch Muslim prisoners. And it has even been confirmed in official military investigations, like that of the Schmidt Report, conducted by U.S. Southern Command, which has confirmed that female interrogators did grab the genitals of Muslim male prisoners in the course of their interrogation. I think I've been the only person to actually write about how prisoners told me that these female interrogators went even further and actually forced these male prisoners by the hand and forced them to touch the female interrogator herself in private areas, whether on the breast or in the genital areas. Now, when I heard of these types of things, and when many of the other American Muslims who were serving down in Guantanamo, maybe as translators, many of them who attended my religious service for the American Muslim personnel, often confirmed much of what was going on because some of them actually worked inside the interrogation rooms. And when we heard these types of things going on, we not only thought this was degrading to the prisoner, of course, to himself, But we thought this was also degrading to the female interrogator herself. And further, we thought it was degrading to all women in general, because essentially what these female interrogators were doing were simply posing or presenting themselves simply as a sex object in front of a Muslim prisoner. But there were other things that were going on with the regard to the use of religion against the prisoners. Like, for example, the Quran desecration. Now that's something we heard about last year from Newsweek, first reported by Newsweek, that the Quran was being desecrated down in Guantanamo. Now this was news that outraged the entire Muslim world, that led to riots around the world, and even people died in these riots in protest that the Quran was being desecrated down in Gitmo. I myself was outraged when I heard this news, because I knew firsthand from being down in Guantanamo and experiencing firsthand the anti-Muslim hostility down in Guantanamo, directed not only to the Muslim prisoners, but also towards the American Muslims who were serving down there. I myself was outraged. And I can say firsthand from being down in Guantanamo that yes, the Quran was being desecrated down in Guantanamo when I was there. I remember when I initially got down there, the guards themselves were actually allowed to search the Qurans as a matter of security procedure. And I remember seeing them, how they took the Holy Quran. They would open them up, turn them upside down, and shake them violently to see if anything dangerous would fall out. Of course, nothing ever did. And Muslims ourselves know that just hiding something in the Quran would itself be an insult to the Holy Book as well as to Islam. But nevertheless, perhaps there's a need, a necessity for security procedures, especially in a prison operation. But the guards would take the Holy Quran and shake it upside down. Nothing dangerous would fall out, but sometimes the pages themselves would tear right from the bindings, and the bindings themselves would rip and crack. Now, this happened in front of the prisoners in these open-air cage cells. They can see everything that's happening. And the prisoners would be furious. They would be angered. And this is what led to the riots and the protests as to how the guards were treating the Holy Quran. But then they started protesting with more drastic measures like hunger strikes and suicide attempts. But what would drive the prisoners to the extent of wanting to kill themselves in protest of how the Holy Quran was being treated? Well, this occurred when interrogators within the interrogation booths were taking the Holy Quran and throwing it on the ground and then stepping on it. This also has been confirmed by the very same Schmidt report. Prisoners would come back and they would tell me that the interrogators would also kick the Quran across the floor inside the interrogation room. And when the prisoners came back and these reports and incidences were made known to the general population of prisoners, this is when you had the chaos break out and the mass suicide attempts.
James Yee speaking at UC Davis, University of California, Davis, at about a forum on Guantanamo. His book is called Forgotten Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. He'll speak more after break.
جسد أشبه شيء جسد أشبه شيء بالخيال وفؤادي عن هوى وفؤادي عن هواكم غير سال.
Alayla Helwa by Amir Taufik here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report, as we return now to the former Muslim chaplain James Yee, speaking at a forum on Guantanamo Bay May 5th at UC Davis. He is author of the book For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire.
So they wanted to stop these suicides. these suicide attempts. But they didn't know what to do, so they turned to the Muslim chaplain. What do we do? And this is what I did. I authored a policy that gave proper guidance to all personnel down in Guantanamo on one, how to properly handle the Quran with respect. It was a policy that actually allowed the prisoner himself to show the guard that there's nothing hidden in the Quran. And then that holy Quran would be held and stored in a little holder high up in his cell. And before he's even taken out of his cell on the door unlocked, he is again shackled at the wrist, at the waist, and at the ankles. And only then can he be taken out of his cell to go to recreation or to the shower. So if there was a possibility that he was able to hide a fantasy weapon or some sort in that Quran, there would be virtually no possible way he could go then and retrieve that something and use it to harm anyone. So my policy took into account proper respect for the Holy Quran, but also security procedures necessary for any prison operation. And those are the kind of things I was praised for and recognized for during my time down in Guantanamo. But this is how religion was being used against the prisoners. But what about physical abuse? What kind of physical abuse was occurring? Let me talk to you about some of that. One in particular is an incident, which is pretty humorous, but yet it's pretty sad to recall what actually ended up happening to this prisoner. There was a prisoner who had been returned to his cell, coming back maybe from recreation. And the guard, for whatever reason, failed to lock the door of that cell. Whether it was intentional or unintentional, it depends on whose side of the story you believe, the prisoners or the guard. But nevertheless, he's in a cell that's unlocked. Adjacent to that prisoner is an empty cell. The prisoner who's supposed to be in that cell is down in the secured recreation area, being guarded by one guard. On every cell block, there are four guards. The other three guards were now searching that cell as a matter of security. That's when the cell searches take place, when the prisoner is down in recreation. The prisoner, who's now in an empty cell, in an unlocked cell, comes out of his cell and attempts to lock the three guards in that cell while they're conducting the search. Very clever. The fourth guard down the corridor sees what's happening. He comes rushing down. The four guards, they're probably all over 200 pounds, are no match for that one prisoner. They're easily able to manhandle that prisoner down to the ground, slam him down, face down. His hands are now cuffed behind his back. His legs are shackled. The incident should have stopped there. Perhaps that prisoner should have been punished, taken to solitary confinement, a cell which we call MSU, Maximum Security Unit. But the incident didn't stop there. One of the guards continued to bludgeon that prisoner on the back of the head after already being shackled at the ankles and his wrist behind his back. And of course, it was a bloody affair. There was blood all over. By the time I responded to the scene, the prisoner had already been taken to the infirmary, to the detention medical facility to get his head stitched up. But I wrote about how I witnessed and how I saw that pool of blood on the floor. And what I thought, what I saw in this pool of blood, were chunks of flesh that had been from that prisoner's head. I also witnessed how the other prisoners who witnessed everything that had just happened in these open cell cages, how they were all in a state of shock. And how the other guards who were involved in this incident were themselves severely shaken because they had to pull their own colleague off the back of that prisoner. Clearly, this was an incident in which excessive use of force was applied. So yes, there was also physical abuse that occurred down in Guantanamo. I can go on with things that happened in Guantanamo, like the ages of some of the prisoners down there. As young as 12 to 14 years old, prisoners as young as 12 to 14 years old were being held down in Guantanamo when I was there. I had access to them on a weekly basis. And I recall distinctly meeting with these youngsters and my conversations with the guards who oversaw the detention of these youngsters. I recall how sometimes, or once, a guard said, "Chaplain, these youngsters, these preteens, sometimes they do get out of hand, and they're like any other preteens. They gang up on each other, they make fun of each other, and sometimes they do have to be disciplined. Well, I said, well, what do? He said, Chaplain, we give them a timeout. A timeout. Now, what's a timeout? A timeout is something I use with my own 6-year-old daughter when she's naughty or when she's had too much chocolate. I give her a timeout to have her calm down and go to her room and be silent. This is what was being used on these youngsters who senior military officials said of them, they're not individuals on a little league team. These are individuals on a major league team called terrorism. Now, I question the logic on whether or not a timeout would be effective on a hardcore terrorist. Would a timeout be effective on someone like Osama bin Laden? The reality is these individuals, these youngsters, these 12-year-olds, were not hardcore terrorists. They were there for over a year, and they've been, I believe, subsequently released. These are the type of things that were going on down in Guantanamo. But my contributions down there, I was praised for by the commanding general, Major General Jeffrey Miller. I received 2 official military awards signed by him and had been recommended for a third. Received letters of recognition from the commanding general. And I had received a stellar officer evaluation report, the best that I had ever received, dated 2 days before I would be arrested and then charged and accused of things like spying, espionage, and aiding the enemy. And I want to talk to you about that. How did that happen? Well, I was coming home in September of 2003 for what I thought would be a short 2-week break. I landed in Jacksonville Naval Air Station, the first stop where U.S. service members come back into the country after being in Guantanamo. The customs officials, they stopped and they searched my bags. It was interesting because when they directed me to get my bags, I went to the pile of luggage where all the luggage had been unloaded from the plane. But lo and behold, beside this pile of luggage were my 2 bags already set aside. And I was wondering how that happened. Nevertheless, it was very convenient. I was able to grab those 2 bags and give them to the customs officials. Disturbingly, I would actually learn that it was the FBI, who had contacted the customs officials even as early as the day before my arrival and again the morning of my arrival, requesting them specifically to single me out, identify me before I even get off the plane, and have my bags searched. And that's what happened. So we no longer have a routine customs search, but instead we have now a search being conducted by an extension of a law enforcement agency, the FBI, without probable cause. A violation, of course, of my Fourth Amendment right to be free from an illegal search and seizure. Didn't matter too much to me because it's not like I had anything, but then it would matter. Because these customs officials would say, oh, we got some suspicious documents in his backpack. And then these suspicious documents were immediately, within seconds, handed over to several federal and military intelligence officers who, by the way, just happened to be standing by. No, it wasn't a coincidence. It was a sting operation. And then these intelligence officers would say, not only were these documents suspicious, but they are classified documents. And then they would be able to get an arrest warrant, and then I was thrown in jail, for which would ultimately be for 76 days in isolation. I was arrested in secret, held incommunicado. I never showed up at the airport in Seattle like I was supposed to have, where my wife and daughter were waiting. They didn't know what happened to me. My parents in New Jersey had no idea what had happened. I essentially disappeared from society, from the face of the earth. But my family would learn of what happened to me. 10 days later, when government leaks to the media were then reported, first by the Washington Times, that I was now arrested and charged with these heinous crimes of spying, espionage, aiding the enemy, and mutiny and sedition, which is like trying to overthrow the government. All of these capital crimes. And yes, I was threatened with the death penalty days after my arrest by a military prosecutor. But now I was sitting in a super maximum security prison down in Charleston, South Carolina. Interestingly enough, the prison in which they sent me to is the very same prison in which they hold the U.S. citizen enemy combatants. Foreign enemy combatants, we know, are held down in Guantanamo and these other secret CIA black sites that we've heard about. Enemy combatants declared by our U.S. president that are U.S. citizens are held in Charleston, South Carolina at the Consolidated Naval Brig. And that's where they sent me. And I believe it was a U.S. Southern Command public affairs representative, I believe it was on Amy's show, who said this was only a coincidence that they sent me to this very same prison. But I know it wasn't a coincidence because of the way in which they transported me there. I was taken from Jacksonville, shackled like prisoners are shackled down in Guantanamo at the wrist and at the waist and at the ankles in what we call in the military a three-piece suit. Not a three-piece suit like you buy at the mall, made by Armani, a three-piece suit of chains. This is how I was shackled. And then thrown in the back of a truck next to an armed guard, two other armed guards in the front. And down on this way, on this trip to Charleston, the guard pulls out of this bag these goggles. They're blackened out, opaque. Puts them on my eyes, so now I can't see a thing. He takes out these heavy industrial-type earmuffs, the likes that you might see a construction worker wearing when he's jackhammering in the middle of the street. Puts them on my ears, and now I can't hear a thing. We call this tactic sensory deprivation. Sensory deprivation. It's something that I recently read that the American Psychiatric Association has included in a draft of their definition of torture. Sensory deprivation. I was subjected to sensory deprivation, but I knew about this tactic. Because that's, of course, how I saw prisoners being treated and subjected to when they are in process into Guantanamo, when they're flown in from Afghanistan, under this very same tactic of sensory deprivation. Its purpose, which is meant to instill fear and intimidation. You yourselves maybe have seen the pictures with the prisoners wearing the hoods on their head. Well, I feared also that a hood would be then thrown on my head. But fortunately for me, that practice of hooding had just been stopped months before my arrest. I also feared of being kicked and beaten violently, especially after hearing some of the prisoners when I spoke with them down in Guantanamo, how they were kicked and beaten during their transport down to Guantanamo. One prisoner, as I've written about, even said, "Chaplain, if you look in my medical records, you'll see that I've even been treated by Army medics for being kicked and beaten so violently when I was brought here." I feared that I was going to be subjected to this same type treatment. So when they threw me in a cell down in Charleston, South Carolina, in solitary confinement, in isolation, I was at least relieved that I was still alive. But what was life like in that prison cell for me for those 76 days down in Charleston? One of the most ironic parts of the situation is that down in Guantanamo, as the Muslim chaplain, I was able to protect certain religious rights for the alleged, suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners down in Guantanamo. I was able to ensure that the call to prayer was made five times a day over a loudspeaker. I was able to ensure that in every cell an arrow was painted directing them towards Mecca so they can properly make their prayers. I was able to ensure that every meal that is served to Muslim prisoners in Guantanamo is what we call halal, meaning the meat. The meals are prepared according to Islamic guidelines, a concept similar to kosher. I was able to ensure that meal schedules were adjusted during the holy month of Ramadan to accommodate for the holy fasting of that month. But when I, a U.S. citizen, was taken into U.S. military custody and thrown into a maximum security prison, I was denied my religious rights. Yes, the prison chaplain came to see me, and he knew that I was a Muslim chaplain. And of course, by this time, it's high profile as it has hit the news. The chaplain asked me if I needed anything, and I said yes. Could you get me the five prayer times so that I can make my Muslim prayers during their correct time. And I even gave him a website, www.islamicfinder.org. Type in the zip code and you can get the prayer times for Charleston, South Carolina. He said, sorry, I can't give it to you. The security section won't allow me to give you that type of information. I said, well, how about just a quick confirmation to the northeasterly direction so that I can at least pray in the right direction. Northeast from North America. Mecca is to the northeast from North America. He said, sorry, I can't give you that either. The security section won't allow me to give you even that information. And I interpreted that to mean that if he gave me the northeasterly direction, then I, of course, being a military soldier, would be able to determine which way was north, south, east, and west. And that information would help me if I was able to escape from this super maximum security prison, because then I would know which way to run. The point is, I was denied my religious rights as a U.S. citizen in military custody. This is the very same rights that I was able to uphold for prisoners down in Guantanamo. With that, I have to say that after 76 days, I was suddenly released. I was never charged officially with those heinous crimes. I was charged with some lesser offenses of mishandling classified documents, which the military tried to prosecute me on. I was facing still some 13 or 14 years in prison. Went to a pretrial hearing. The very first thing my now civilian legal representation did was to simply ask for the results of an official review of these documents that they had seized from me to show that I had something that was classified. And again, disturbingly, we learned that the government and the military had never even initiated such a review of these documents. And so this pretrial hearing was delayed, delayed again, and then again, and then again. And then all of a sudden, all of the charges that were brought against me were simply dropped. I was returned to full duty back at Fort Lewis, reinstated as a Muslim chaplain. My record was wiped clear, after which I, of course, tendered my resignation, received an honorable discharge in January 2005, and upon separation, I would receive a second Army Commendation Medal for exceptional meritorious service.
Very kind. Good story.
I didn't receive an apology. Yes, I am an eternal optimist, and I hope one day that I'll receive an official policy, and I believe that by speaking out, speaking the truth, and making people aware of what's going on in Guantanamo, and letting others know what happened to me as a U.S. citizen held in this so-called war on terrorism, that one day all of this will lead to a well-deserved apology. Thank you.
Good job.
James Yee, former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo Bay, author of For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire, the book that chronicles his experience. James Yee was speaking at UC Davis, University of California, Davis, on May 5th on a panel, a conversation about Guantanamo that I moderated. The others there were University of Wisconsin professor Alfred McCoy, who wrote the book A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, and Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who wrote with Ellen Ray Guantanamo, What the World Should Know. And the CCR, the center, has also published a book, Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. I look forward to seeing people on June 3rd at Columbia University in New York at Lerner Hall. I'll be there with Professor Noam Chomsky, as well as a number of other panelists. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Chris Zucker, Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.